Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Zingari. And, I promised or said we might have Warren Cromartie, former outfielder for the Montreal Expos, on. He's actually the founder and president of something called the Montreal Baseball Project, and that is the group that has been working for a number of years now to get Montreal in place to get a Major League Baseball team again. And I'll tell you some things about that as we have the half hour to go on. But unfortunately, Warren right now is in Japan. I know for a while he was a consultant with the Yomiuri Giants, who he's played for. We had tried to get together to do this morning, 9 o'clock our time. It is 10 o'clock in the evening in Japan right now. Unfortunately, communicating across 13 hours of time zones doesn't always work. And so, not able to get, Warren Cromartie on with us this morning. Maybe if the spaceman is listening, Bill Lee up in Craftsbury, maybe he'll, call in this morning at 244-1777. Or 877-291-8255 to offer his opinion. We, of course, love the spaceman, played for the Sox and the Expos, so our two local teams, and, of course, accorded himself quite well. But we do have a guest in the newsroom right now, somebody I'd like you to meet. His name is Craig Durham, and Craig has been practicing, been getting up to speed, doing some news with Brady in the afternoon. And as of Monday, he will be on the morning news service along with Lee Cattell. So, Craig, welcome to WDEV.
Thank you so much.
All right. And, Craig, first of all, since you probably will not, you know, at 6 a.m., you're going to be reading news, and there's probably little time during that that shift where people will get to hear your whole story, your background. So why don't you tell people, first of all, you know, who you are, where you're from, what you've been doing?
Well, that's a loaded question, but I'll do my best.
All right.
I'm not a born Vermonter, and I'm sure in many eyes still not a Vermonter, though I've lived here since 2018. I've been working in baseball pretty much my adult life since graduating college. I started working in minor league baseball, started in the Cape Cod League first, and then spent a couple of years with the Blue Jays down in Dunedin, went to the Diamondbacks AA team in Mobile, Alabama for a season. Like you'd expect, that year in Alabama led me to a year in Australia, working for MLB.com and the Australian Baseball League's Melbourne Aces. Then I came back, lived a year in Canada, started doing hockey. Was working in North Bay, Ontario for the Battalion. And then 2 years with the Providence Bruins, summers in Helena, Montana with the Brewers minor league affiliate there. So just a minor league sports sort of rambler for a while.
Wow.
Yeah.
I do love that. I can tell you've at least spent some time in Australia because, you know, it's Melbourne, not Melbourne, as a lot of Americans like to pronounce it. So well done.
Well, yeah, that was my home for 9 months. Met my wife there. She's Canadian. It's been a wild ride for sure.
Wow. I dated a woman from Sydney, Australia for a while. So, but I've never been. So I'm going to love to pick your brain and hear tales of what that beautiful country is like. Now, we're going to talk some baseball here. I'll just give some info to people of what I know about the Montreal Baseball Project until we can get Warren Cromartie on sometime next week. But you've got some baseball. You said you got the baseball background, but you got some baseball commentating coming up later this month.
That's right. Yeah, Memorial Day will be the first day of play at the Baseball America's Qualifier, the WBSC, the World Baseball Softball Confederation, which is essentially baseball's version of FIFA.
Mm-hmm.
They've been my employer since 2015. They send me all around the world to cover World Cup events, and lately it's been Olympic qualifiers with a big layoff here. So we're really excited for this event to get underway. It's 5 days. It's eight teams. You've got Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, Venezuela, Cuba, the United States, Nicaragua, Colombia, and Canada, all vying for the fifth spot in the Olympics. The first four teams are already set. You've got the hosts, Japan, Korea, Israel, and Mexico. Mexico beat the United States in a walk-off win in what was a play-in game. That was at the Tokyo Dome in Japan a couple of years ago. I was lucky enough to call that game, and it was a thriller. So the United States is still not qualified. This is one of their last two chances.
That's interesting. Where are these games going to be played?
They're going to be played in Florida, split between West Palm Beach and Port St. Lucie. So the spring training home of the Mets, Port St. Lucie, and West Palm is the Nats and Astros. They share the facility. So there'll be two games a day at each venue for the first 3 days. And then the super round will be the last 2 days, the teams with the four best records from round robin play. One day that'll be in Port St. Lucie, the other in West Palm.
Back in the day, and I lived down in West Palm, they used to be that's where the Montreal Expos trained, and they were a Montreal Expos farm club, Florida State League farm club back in the day. So I used to go see the West Palm Beach Expos play, but I think they've at least gussied up that stadium or replaced it, and I know Jupiter has that beautiful new park there.
Yeah, Jupiter's got a great one, and this one I'm really excited to see. As you said, it's a brand new stadium. It's called the Ballpark of the Palm Beaches, and I think it's only been open 2 or 3 years. And all the reports are that it's just magnificent. So excited to be there. I'm not sure which stadium I'll be at the opening round. I'll be calling those games solo and then paired up with my buddy Tyler Maughan, who does these games with me.
And they're going to be on ESPN?
ESPN Plus, yeah. Big announcement last week. First partnership between the WBSC and ESPN Plus. All the games will be streaming live, two a day, a game at 1 o'clock and a game at 7 o'clock, weather permitting.
And who are on these teams, especially for the U.S.? You know, these aren't our major leaguers, so what's the makeup of the team? We would think if our major leaguers, we would have probably qualified already.
Well, the funny thing is they should have qualified. I'm sure if you talk to U.S. baseball people, because their best shot was at the tournament called the Premier 12 in Tokyo, and it was some of the biggest young stars in baseball. Bobby Dalbec, the Red Sox first baseman, was on that team. Andrew Vaughn, big prospect, he was on that team. A number of players, Caleb Thielbar pitches for the Twins, and they just didn't get the job done. They lost that game, as I said, in a walk-off to Mexico. And so this time around, 40-man roster players cannot participate, which really shrinks the talent pool. So it'll be minor leaguers, double-A guys, triple-A guys, but people who their MLB teams don't put them on the 40-man roster.
Wow. All right. So Monday you start on the morning news service here at WDEV, probably a nice 3 or 3:30 a.m.
Oh, yeah.
Wake up. So
can't wait.
Have you done anything that required you to get up at that time of day on a consistent basis?
Other than opening, when we first moved to Vermont, I was opening the Uncommon Market Thursday mornings. So I had to be there at 5:30 to start making the breakfast sandwiches. So that was one day a week. I've never done it 5 days a week. So I'm really looking forward to it. I've been practicing for sure.
All right. Well, you know, there are a lot of people who get up that early around here, so we can have people call you and get you out of bed, wake you up, make sure.
Let's hope we don't need to go down that road.
All right. Craig Durham starts Monday on the morning news service here at WDEV along with Lee Cattell. So welcome to the family. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much. This was great.
All right. Expect that Warren Cromartie, former Expos outfielder this morning. Unfortunately, we just didn't get that job done of linking up and having him on. We'll try to get that for you next week. The reason being, the Oakland A's have made noises now about moving because they're not getting a new stadium after all these years. It is a pretty old, ragged stadium at this point, built back in the 60s, Oakland Alameda Media Stadium originally called. And, it's seen better days. So they have been trying to get something done for a number of years. Hasn't been they haven't been successful. So Montreal is on that list of places where they could land if they do indeed leave Oakland. And we'll hear from Warren Cromartie, who is the founder and president of something called the Montreal Baseball Project, about where they are, what strides they've made. And I'll tell you what I know if I have time this morning. But let's go to the phones. We've got Stephen from Montpelier joining us. Hi, Stephen. Go right ahead.
Good morning. I just wanted to mention that people are getting outdoors quite a lot.
Yeah.
And the Vermont River Conservancy has a number of projects with the goal of having either a swimming hole or a waterfall conserved in every Vermont town. And the other day, I went with the executive director to Wolcott, where we went to a waterfall in Sheffield and Wheelock. Now, those aren't definite projects, but they're examples of some of the projects that are in the books.
Excellent. And
in addition to the North Branch Cascades and the Confluence Park in Montpelier.
Mm-hmm. So you said they would like to have one in every town in the state. How far along in this quest are they right now?
I believe there are about 90 areas conserved.
Oh, wow. That's a strong start. Vermont River Conservancy.org.
And then, of course, there's the whole...
Go ahead.
There's a whole trail along the Connecticut River from Canada to Long Island Sound, a paddler's trail.
Oh, that's neat. Can somebody find that at the River Conservancy website?
Yes, there is an interactive map that you can just go to VermontRiverConservancy.org, and you can get the interactive map. There's also a hut on the Nalhegan River where people can spend the night.
Oh, I love it.
And we're going to do another hut on the Nalhegan and a campsite at Dennis Pond. And there are a lot of projects in the works right now. It's going to be a very, very busy summer.
Mm, fantastic. Stephen, I do hope you'll be tuning in at what time do I have that? Let's see. Next up, 9:30, because we're going to talk about those derelict deadbeat dams, and I've got a couple people to talk about removing those and the damage they do. So be sure to listen.
Interestingly enough, the project in Sheffield and Wheelock were old dams that were removed, and now they're beautiful waterfalls.
Love it. All right.
And so anyway.
That's great to hear. All right, Stephen, thanks for calling, and I'll give that, again, the website, VermontRiverConservancy.org. You can see that paddle trail down the Connecticut River, but also if you have a spot, a town that could qualify for what Stephen was talking about, you can let them know, the River Conservancy, at VermontRiverConservancy.org. Okay, Hardwick we go to next. Bob, how you doing?
All right, yep. Fighting a good battle against injustice, but I've volunteered the River Conservancy, and I tried to conserve my place with them, and I have multiple waterfalls on here, Cascade, Little Falls, one of the falls is the fourth tallest in the state, second widest, the most handicapped accessible in the state. And it's the only place in the world featuring two lighted waterfalls in a lighted park. And I tried to conserve this for the last 20 years.
Hmm.
And the River Conservancy actually just flat out lied to me to get me to sign a contract with them about how the appraisal was going to be done. They lied about it to get me to sign this contract. And then when it got done, they were just trying to scam me out of the place. They were supposed to use comparables of like properties and like attractions. And instead, they just compared it to three local houses, one of which we owned previously and was only on 1 acre of land with one tree on it. And they called that a comparable. And having worked on the house and the property, known it for 50 years, it was no comparison at all. It was just a total joke and a scam. And it's very bad because I've tried to conserve the most beautiful place in Vermont for the last 20 years, and I've been told by another conservancy agency, the Three Rivers Agency, that they're looking at keeping an eye on the property, and they hope to work with the next owners. Well, here I've been for 65 years and 20 years trying to conserve the place, and I told them, you know what a covenant is? Said, oh, yeah, we use them all the time. Well, I said, I'm going to put a covenant on this place that it won't be conserved for 50 years until it won't be allowed. People won't be allowed until 50 years after my death if this is the way they're going to treat me. I mean, it's just been a joke I've found about these conservation agencies This is the only property in the state that I found out is not conservable.
Bob,
it should have been one of the first ones.
All right, Bob. You know, it sounds like a beautiful spot, and I definitely, you know, feel your pain for not getting this done. It sounds like a spot that should be conserved. Sounds like something Vermont River Conservancy would have jumped on. So I don't know the particulars, if there's legal situations. It doesn't help anybody, though, to cast aspersions one way or the other. So let's just leave it there. I understand you're upset, especially trying to get this done over a couple decades. And I can only hope that it doesn't come to what you're saying you want to do and keep people away from it. It sounds like a place that should be cherished and should be conserved and should be a place where Vermonters get to spend time. I hope that works out. Maybe we can get someone from the Conservancy to reach out and start that process again, and that the two of you, you know, just put things aside and try to get off on the right foot. But the you know, it could be water water under the dam, water over the bridge, whatever it might be, water over the dam at this point. And I hope it's not the case. I hope that beautiful spot there of yours in Hardwick can be conserved. It sounds like from what Stephen said earlier, our call before you, that this is the kind of thing that the Vermont River Conservancy would be looking to do. So let's hope they're going to step up and the two of you can and start discussions again. We're at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Those are our numbers if you'd like to discuss anything right now. We've got about 5 minutes left of open phones before we take a break for CBS News and then come back and talk about those deadbeat derelict dams, which should be pretty interesting. I was supposed to have Warren Cromartie on this morning. We just couldn't get it done. He's over in Japan, and the time difference can be a little difficult sometimes for arranging interviews like this. But I will tell you this. Here's what I do know. So Warren Cromartie, who played in that great outfield with Andre Dawson and Ellis Valentine, one of the most amazing outfields in Major League history, with speed, talent, hitting, they had great arms and defense, and young and vibrant. It was really exciting to watch, the three of them play together. As Lee Cattell mentioned, at some point, I think it was after about 4 or 5 years, Ron LaFleur was traded for, brought in to play center field, and, they moved the Crow to first base, and he had to kind of learn that, not unlike Hanley Ramirez, when you remember Hanley for the Red Sox a few years ago, was shifted from the outfield to play first base. And at first, Hanley looked like, you know, he was having a real problem over there. But just like Hanley, the Crow took all kinds of extra fielding practice and became a serviceable first baseman. And that was a neat thing to see with Hanley, too, how he took that on. But Cromartie started a project called the Montreal Baseball Project a number of years ago. And, you know, he had to sound when he started as if this was just an absolutely ludicrous idea. The Expos were taken away from Montreal by the league. Moved, at one point, Bud Selig wanted to, if you remember this, wanted to contract and wanted to get rid of the Twins and the Expos. And was going to reduce the number of teams in the major leagues by two. And those were the teams he was going to excommunicate. Now they've done it with minor league baseball. This is a big problem, I think. But nonetheless, eventually they moved the Expos to Washington. They've won a World Series now. But Crow, you know, when he started this thing in Montreal, it sounded like a pipe dream, sounded ludicrous. Major League Baseball has said there's no way they're going to go back to the Big O and play at Olympic Stadium. There's a covering over that roof that leaks, and it would cost a ridiculous amount to even fix that, and let alone how much it would need to be poured into that stadium built back when in the late 60s, early 70s for the Olympics. So it sounded insane, and little by little, he has beat the drum for getting Major League Baseball back to Montreal. It has included putting together a strong ownership group that includes one of the Bronfmans, who are quite wealthy. They have put a realistic price tag on what it will cost to buy a Major League team, to build a new stadium. They have found a site downtown. They want to fashion it after what has been done in Minneapolis with the Twins. Beautiful stadium there. Target Field, probably about 35,000, and open air, and have character. It'll be close to a metro stop. As a matter of fact, in a few years, if everything happens the way it should be happening, you will be able to hop a train here in Vermont, go right up to Montreal, hop off, and get on what they're calling the REM, which they're building right now, a new system. Hop off the train to Montreal, get on the REM, and get right down to the new, I'll say, Expos Stadium, for lack of a better term. I'm pretty sure they're going to keep the name Expos and probably that great uniform that was like no other. The other thing that's happened is that Major League Baseball, Rob Manfred a few years ago, hatched this plan where Tampa Bay and Montreal would both build new stadiums, and they'd spend half the year playing as in Tampa Bay and half the year playing in Montreal. We'll see how that goes. Sounds like a bit of a ludicrous plan, but Major League Baseball hatched it and has given it the blessing. And would you take half a year of Major League Baseball in the AL East, playing against the Sox, playing against the Yankees? Yeah, I mean, you get against Toronto. Think of the natural rivalries that could occur. So that's some of the stuff we'll talk about with Crow when we get him on, hopefully next week. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will be talking about those derelict deadbeat dams. And I want to remind you that coming up at 11 this morning, we'll bring you the Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I forgot the name of the show. Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Earlier this week, Jared Carpenter of Trout Unlimited mentioned on this show that Vermont had a vast number of derelict deadbeat dams. My first thought was, wow, what an incredible band name. Only thing is, once they get huge, they'll be known as DDD, so not as interesting. But my second thought, a far better one, was that we need to learn more about what they are, why they are, what they're doing to our waterways, and who's looking after these bad boys. So for this special Derelict Deadbeat Dams edition of Vermont Viewpoint, I've brought in the people who know them best. Karina Daly is the Ecological Restoration Coordinator for the Vermont Natural Resources Council. Karina, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you, Rick. Happy to be here.
Excellent. And Ron Rhodes is the Director of Restoration Programs for the Connecticut River Conservancy. Ron, it's great to have you here as well.
Good morning, Rick.
Good morning. And listeners, if you've got a question for our guests or know of a derelict deadbeat dam that you would like to see removed, give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Karina, I know I get excited to talk about this because of the phrase derelict deadbeat dams, but let's go to the heart of it. First of all, what is a derelict deadbeat dam?
Good question. A derelict deadbeat dam is a dam that no longer serves a useful purpose. So it is a dam that, you know, at one point it was an old mill dam, potentially, or a water control structure, so used for water or mill, and the dam has just been sitting in the river, abandoned, and no longer serving that purpose. So those are the dams that we call derelict deadbeat dams. They're blocking the river. They're creating an impoundment behind the dam, and those are the ones we're working to remove.
And how many of these dams are in Vermont, and fitting that description of being derelict?
We think there's over 800 known derelict dams, but there's more coming out of the rivers all the time. People are calling, so there definitely could be more out there than we have data on. But we think there's about 800.
And then are there still, positive functioning dams in the state, and how many of those would we have?
We certainly have, a large amount of hydropower dams that are still providing power. And I don't have a number on those, but I don't know if Ron does. But, yes, we aren't targeting those dams. We're targeting those abandoned dams that no longer serve their useful purpose.
Ron, do you have an idea on how many of those hydro dams that are still doing positive work on our waterways?
Well, we've got 13 hydro dams on the Connecticut River that are helping, generate power. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers flood control dams, and we have about a dozen of those in our watershed here on the east side of the state.
Gotcha. These derelict dams, Ron, how long have they been sitting idle and blocking waterways with no real useful purpose?
Well, each one, of course, has its own unique history. We've taken out some dams that were built in the late 70s, early 80s as a way to, offset the oil crisis. And then we've taken out dams that were originally built, like wood crib dams originally built in the 1800s and then, added on over the years. So you might actually have three old dams in one site, the original wood crib dam and then sort of a rock concrete, cap to it, and then a more modern concrete that might have been done in the early 20s.
All right, let's dig into why they're a problem. Karina, what are the problems that the derelict dams create?
They disconnect a river system. So rivers are a dynamic system. They need to move. They transport water, sediment, and habitat with them, including fish species and various other aquatic species. And when you block that system, you create an impoundment behind that dam, and it changes the habitat from a free-flowing river to almost a lake-like system behind that dam. That's the impoundment. And the sediment piles up behind that dam. The water temperature changes, the temperature goes down, and it reduces dissolved oxygen. And it's that barrier that disconnects habitat for fish species and recreation and water quality. So it really fragments the system.
Now, these dams have been sitting there, for decades, maybe even a century or longer. Haven't the aquatic life there, Karina, adapted over that amount of time and are now comfortable in that environment that exists today?
I would say the aquatic life behind a dam is less diverse, and it changes from, warm water fish species. So you create a lake-like habitat, which has different fish species than a river, cold water Vermont trout stream, which our rivers are. And those species depend on cold water, and they migrate for their life. Most freshwater fish species migrate. So they really need that connectivity for movement. And same with the sediment behind it. That sediment needs to be transported to create riverbanks downstream and build habitat for wildlife.
Yeah, Ron, I watched a video of the removal of a dam, and I think the first thing that was being done was kind of dredging out that sediment. How thick does that sediment develop, and what's the problem with that sediment?
So I'll give you an example, Rick. A few years ago, we did dam removal up in East Burke, and the dam was about 10 feet high, and there was 9 feet of sediment that had collected behind the dam. So you only had about 1 foot of water. And, if you tried to walk out there, you were sinking up to your knees in mud. Mm-hmm. So, yes, the removal process is removing some of that sediment, putting it in trucks, you know, and getting it off the site into a local pit usually, and then hammering out some of the concrete to lower the water table, and then going back and removing some of the sediment as it dries out. So it's a sort of a back and forth process, sediment, concrete, and it takes, you know, weeks and maybe months, depending on the size of the impoundment. If you have some of these old reservoir dams, there's been several of those that have been taken out. We did one in Norwich a few years ago that was 18-foot high concrete structure. We removed 753 truckloads, triaxle trucks, full of sediment.
Wow. Which, yeah. Which without the dam would have just gradually each day slightly, you know, just run down the river without any real problems. And
if the dam failed. Yeah, if the dam failed. You know, these are old concrete dams that are falling apart, right? So at some point, maybe in our lifetime, maybe not, you know, that dam's going to fall apart and fail, and all of that sediment would go downstream and clog up the downstream stretch of the river and potentially do damage. You know, if you're in town, like in East Burke, this dam was right in the middle of town.
Wow.
You know, that could do damage to roads, bridges, buildings, you know, local businesses that are near, you know, that kind of thing.
Wow. And Karina, you had mentioned about the water temperature changing. I'm guessing that the difference between 9 feet of water and 1 foot of water could make a serious difference in the water temperature in that specific area.
Certainly, certainly. Water temperature and water quality, you know, that those instant releases of sediment with a dam failure, we don't want that, but we do want the natural transport of sediment slowly over time, you know, how it historically would move as a river meanders.
And Ron, you know, we're kind of, you know, taking these dams to task, but are there instances where dams have a positive effect, maybe even like a beaver dam?
Certainly, beaver dams can help with you know, climate change and flood storage. So, you know, no one's out there knocking down old beaver dams. In fact, in some cases, we're trying to emulate a beaver dam and creating those structures out of wood. But again, that's a natural process. You know, man-made concrete structures in our rivers are not natural. A woman that used to work for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and helped us do a lot of dam removals said that these old dams are like clogged arteries in our bodies. And, you know, that's how, when we get heart attacks. And that's kind of the same analogy, you know, think about in our rivers. These old dams are the clogged arteries that are giving our streams and our fish and wildlife, you know, heart attacks.
Wow, that's a great analogy. Let's go to the phones. We've got Stephen joining us from Montpelier. Hi, Stephen. Go right ahead.
Yeah, this is a kind of complicated question, and I know there's not one answer. But the basic question is, if a tree with branches falls into a stream or river, is it better to leave it there as habitat or to remove it?
All right. Ron or Karina, which one would want to answer that?
I can take that.
Okay.
So that is providing habitat both for fish species and other aquatic organisms. So if you can leave it in the river, that's ideal because that tree can break down and provide, you know, numerous benefits to the river, both as shade and that, in fact, we are putting in river systems wood, you know, wood, coarse woody debris to aid in fish habitat and aquatic organism habitat. That's ideal. They can cause hazards for recreation, kayaking, you know, those strainers can catch currents. So if there is a way, if it is blocking, you know, a major recreational area, if you can buck it up and, you know, place it strategically so that it allows for that habitat and still, you know, allows recreation, that's ideal.
All right, great. Now, Ron, how do you make the determination that a dam falls into my favorite category, the derelict deadbeat dam?
Often, Rick, it's up to the dam owner. You know, most of the dams that we're working on are privately owned, and oftentimes, you know, people buy a piece of property or a house and all of a sudden they've become a dam owner also. And, you know, they're looking for help because, you know, again, it's not serving any useful purpose. Maybe in a spring flood or in an Irene type of event, it actually is creating a flood hazard, doing destruction on their property, et cetera. And so, you know, they're looking for help with removing that dam. And essentially, they've determined that it's time for it to go. In other cases, the state does have a dam safety office, and the staff go out and review and inspect dams. And occasionally, a dam will be determined to be a high hazard, and the state tells the owner either you have to repair it or remove it.
And then, Ron, once identified, what steps must be followed to have it removed?
Well, there's a long process. It's, you know, if everything goes perfectly, you're talking about a 3-year process to get, you know, the design, the assessment, the design. You know, you have to have an engineer come out, survey work has to be done. You have to get permits from the state, federal, and sometimes local governments. You know, as much as I would love to take some concrete out by dynamite, they don't let us do that.
That might be a good thing, Ron, and I'm glad that there are certain rules and regulations. Karina, how often are dams approved for removal?
Well, I would say we're removing, you know, as in Vermont, between 3 to 5 a year. That's a little high, but I think Ron's got 3 planned for this year, and I've got hopefully at least 1. And it's really a funding question, too. I think that's the biggest part, is trying to come up with the funding. These dams are not cheap to remove. It takes a lot of partners. It's a big partnership, and it takes time to raise that money.
Yeah, let's talk about that, the partnership. Who is responsible for the removal of the dam, ultimately, Karina?
Well, the project manager is overseeing it. In that case, it could be Ron, it could be me, it could be another watershed organization managing that piece. We're working to empower more folks to take on that role. But the landowner ultimately, you know, is signing off on the support of the dam removal. So they're a big part of it. There's multiple permits involved, both at the federal and state level, with Army Corps of Engineers, state stream alteration, wetlands potentially, dam safety. So many people are responsible, and it's a process, and it takes a lot of collaboration.
Part of me, Karina, you know, is excited that this is being done. But if it's, you know, just 4 or 5 a year and there are 800 of these these dams, you know, I'm doing the math, that's a couple hundred years that it'll take us to remove them all.
You got it. Yep. It's going to take time unless we can, you know, creatively come up with some more funding. And we're constantly working on how to make the process more efficient from a permitting and design perspective. But it takes thought, and you have to, you know, prepare downstream landowners for what the river's going to look like when it's restored. It's an exercise in thinking about what the river looked like before the dam was there and recreating that piece.
Gotcha. Now, Ron, we've removed the dynamite from your hands. So let's talk about the removal, the actual removal of a dam. You know, what's the process like? Take us through the steps of removing a dam.
Well, as you mentioned before, there's lots of partners involved and contractors. You know, this is usually we're talking about big yellow machines in the river, right? Mm-hmm. We've got excavators. They're hammering out the concrete. You've got bucket loaders, you know, taking out the sediment. You've got trucks up and down, you know, the banks of the river. So it is messy, and, you know, it sort of looks like a war zone during the project. And that's one thing we always try to prepare people, especially if we're in a public place. You know, like, this is going to be loud. This is going to be messy. But, you know, once you're done, you get those immediate benefits. You know, you get new waterfalls are created that were buried under the sediment, like in East Burke. You know, people are now swimming and paddling in the spring. You know, whitewater paddlers go there now. So there's lots of benefits to the projects, but it does take, you know, some time and local resources. You know, we're usually hiring, you know, Vermont engineering firms, Vermont trucking companies, Vermont excavator operators to do these projects. So, you know, it is expensive, but the nice thing is, you know, we're going to spend almost $1 million this year on restoration work in the Connecticut River watershed. And most, if not all of that money is going to our local communities and our local economies.
And I'm just thinking, Karina, of that aquatic life. Okay, the dam is gone, but you still do have waterfalls, right? You still have a level change. So how do fish get from down here to up there, or that small aquatic life, you know, that want to get upstream?
Yeah, and some, you know, some, most of the dams, or a lot of the dams, were strategically put in places where there was bedrock outcrops and some natural waterfalls. Mm-hmm. In some cases, those are a permanent barrier to fish passage, and we have to accept that. And but that doesn't mean that leaving the dam in place is better, because we're still, you know, blocking that sediment transport, blocking that cold water habitat, just that access to cold water for those trout species. But, and you'd be surprised, during storm events and high flows, those trout can get up some pretty big falls. So they manage to find their ways when this, you know, they take advantage of those seasonal fluctuations in water levels.
I've seen them doing the deal up there in the kingdom, where they jump up the falls. And is that coming up, or have they already done that for the year? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
Yes, I
usually in April.
April. Okay, yeah. So I missed it the year. But it really is a phenomenal dance of nature to see them work their way up the falls and upstream.
It sure is. It sure is.
All right. Anything we haven't discussed about derelict deadbeat dams? You know, someone has one. How do they report it, for instance?
They can call the NRC or Connecticut River Conservancy. Dam safety, the state has, is taking calls. The Vermont Agency of Natural Resources Natural Resource Atlas is a map, online map, that shows the dam inventory list of all the dams in the state. The NRC, I chair the Vermont Dam Task Force, which is a group of concerned citizens, state and federal agencies, anglers, fish biologists, freshwater advocates, and we meet every other month to discuss the dam removal work in the state and collaborate on ways to reconnect rivers and restore habitat.
Outstanding. Karina Daly is the Ecological Restoration Coordinator for the Vermont Natural Resources Council, and Ron Rhodes is the Director of Restoration Programs for the Connecticut River Conservancy. I want to thank you both for this informative discussion. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, take care. We're going to break now for CBS News. When we get back, we're going to talk to our national correspondent, Bob Ney. And to look ahead to Monday on the show, we're going to be speaking with State Treasurer Beth Pierce, as well as remembering the life of M. Dickey Drysdale of the Herald of Randolph. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. It's time to get a look at what has been happening in the news with our national correspondent, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Rick.
And Bob, are we turning the corner on our COVID numbers now?
Right. You know, one thing I've always appreciated about you is that you always, you know, look at the numbers every single week, which, mm-hmm. not everybody does that. We tend to, you know, overlook things. And just breaking them down a little bit, since you and I talked last week, the total deaths in the United States has increased by 4,334 since we last talked, which, when I say increase, that is obviously slowing down.
Yeah.
So we've had 4,000-some deaths, which, you know, one's too many, but, you know, it's slowed down. Worldwide, 90,000 more people basically 91,000 more people have died in the world. So the world rate, obviously, they've got to get more vaccines out there. I talked to somebody, by the way, in India about 15 minutes ago to check in with people that I know, and they have not gotten the vaccine because they said people are dying in droves in India from getting the vaccine. I pointed out to my friend 93 people have died out of millions vaccinated. So, you know, you're running into that in other parts of the world, too.
Wow, that hesitancy,
Right, that's it, yes.
So how do we compare here in the States, the vaccination rates compared to other countries around the globe?
Oh, we're doing, we're really doing good. I mean, global vaccination. And there's one, in that question you just asked, Rick, there's one thing that just, it puzzles me, it sticks out. In China, daily vaccinations have more than doubled over the last month and are now on par with the U.S. So we, per capita, we're ahead of China. And it's been adjusted, of course, what I just told you for the population. Yeah. So China now accounts for about a third of every vaccinated person in the world. But China returned 2 months ago to basically normal. So I'm looking at this. It kind of makes me shake my head. Doesn't make sense, honestly, about China.
Right.
The European Union is now carrying out more daily vaccinations per 100 residents than both the U.S. and China. So they've really picked it up. 30% have had a dose. India, of course, is just in trouble. And Russia's rollout is remarkably slow due to a bunch of issues. Japan has been even slower. And across Africa, it's horrible. 1% of people across Africa have had one dose.
Oh, my.
1%.
Wow.
Rest of the world is struggling.
Yeah. What do you make of the CDC's directive this week on masks?
Okay, I'm going to use examples of real life with you today. I called a friend of mine in Florida because they did away with the masks in Florida, you know, this
right.
week. And he said he went into a store in Florida and they said to him, you know, you have to have a mask. And he said, no, I don't. And they said, well, you know, it's our policy in the store. He said, arrest me. And he continued shopping. Now, he's been vaccinated. I just wanted to give you an example, though, of, you know, now that the CDC, and I've got two reflections, I guess, on this. Number one, now that the CDC has said you don't have to have a mask if you're vaccinated, how do you prove a person walks in a place, how do you prove they've been vaccinated or not, you know?
Right.
How does the store prove that? Now, my other thought, though, is this, and I could be completely wrong here, Rick, but my other thought is this. If the CDC, and they're not dumb, they knew when they would say you don't have to have a mask, they knew very well that a lot of people will not wear a mask that have not been vaccinated.
Correct.
So maybe they're confident enough that enough people have been vaccinated that it's not going to particularly be a downside.
Right.
You know, you see what I mean?
I do.
Maybe they think enough have been vaccinated. I don't know. That's just a thought I had.
Well,
Why would they do this otherwise?
I agree. They have to definitely take that into consideration that once you say no masks, the majority of people are going to take them off no matter what, vaccinated or not.
Right.
And, we'd have to have reached a point where hopefully the numbers won't explode. And it is warming up. We're going to do more outdoors. We're getting away from the indoor confinement. So maybe that's been taken into consideration as well. Let's move on to the next subject. Liz Cheney, what happened, why, and what is the importance there?
Yes, and of course, Congresswoman Stefanik has been voted in this morning. She had a challenge by one member, but she, you know, beat that back significantly. She had 134 votes to, I think, his 43 or so. So she's in leadership replacing Cheney. Cheney had a pass, Liz Cheney did the first time. She was given a pass. She voted for impeachment, and the minority leader from California, McCarthy, said, okay, I'm still going to support you. The conference in general supported her, and she stayed in. And then after, you know, a few months here, it ended up she was the subject of, you know, what do you think about Trump? When they would have leadership press conferences, she would be singled out. The media would, you know, corner her. And so it became a point where McCarthy said, you know, this has got to stop. We have to have somebody new in leadership. So they end up actually getting a moderate Republican woman then versus a conservative, which actually, Liz Cheney was a what I'd call a neocon, neoconservative. So for the Republican conference, and I was asked this yesterday on radio in West Virginia, what would I have done? I would have actually supported her the first time, and, you know, she voted her conscience, et cetera. I would not have supported her this time, though. If whether you're Nancy Pelosi or Kevin McCarthy, you can't have a person in leadership that the press continues to have this divisiveness, because the press wants to point that out. I think, being honest about this, Rick, Liz Cheney could have done more to say to the media, that is a done topic. You heard all you're going to hear from me, and let it go.
So she didn't. The media paints this as really a struggle of where the Republican Party is and if it's a party of Trump now. Is this more of just an internal struggle, and that's just a media creation?
Well, you know, it's not all one monolithic thought with the Republican Party, and some people voted for Biden, he's the president, and some people didn't. And I think that, you know, the leadership of the Republican Party is going to obviously say, yes, Joe Biden is the president. President Trump, former president, will continue on with certain things. There's going to be a struggle in the Republican Party. I mean, is it going to boil down in a couple of years from now that are you with Donald Trump or are you with the Republican Party? If it goes that direction, the Republican Party is going to have a problem.
Yeah.
You know, everybody's got to be on their own on this one. I don't think the party can dictate, you know, how people are going to react.
You got it. Let's talk. Let's flip to the Dems. I want to talk about infrastructure. Does President Biden have the full support of the Democrats?
Not at this point in time. Now, I think what President Biden is doing, you know, he had Shelley Moore Capito, a Republican from West Virginia, in his office just yesterday. And it was pretty well, you know, highlighted. She's senior in the Republican Party in the Senate. So he had her there, and she was talking to him about issues. And he's communicated, of course, with Democrats. He has a problem with Senator Manchin and a couple of other Democrats on the infrastructure bill. And the question is, do you tax the corporations to pay for it, or don't you? And then Shelley Moore Capito and others were raising issues about a user tax, gas tax increase, et cetera. So right now, the president is doing, I think, politically, in substance for public policy, too, Rick, is doing his part to say, okay, I'm going to listen to you, I'm going to listen to you, I'm going to listen to you. Now, at some point in time, if he can't get the listen-to-you people together, then there's going to have to be a decision made in the Senate, not the House. Where do you go? Do you try to get the 50 votes plus the vice president, if you're Chuck Schumer? Will you have those 50 votes? Can you peel off a couple of Republicans? So I think, to answer your question, it's a work in progress, but at some point in time, somebody's got to pull the trigger to say, okay, here we go, and this is what we're going with.
Mm-hmm. All right, I do want to go to international story, because this is really, you know, dominating what's going on in the world is what's happening in Israel. So what got this started?
Well, there's an issue, you know, out here about settlements. I have been, by the way, to the Gaza Strip. I have met with the Palestinians, and I have met with Benjamin Netanyahu and some of his predecessors, you know. I've met with them, too, former prime ministers. So I've actually been over there, and, you know, and I've seen the West Bank, and that was before the wall was built. But in the West Bank, there's always been this contentious issue of Jewish settlers moving into the occupied territories, which it's recognized those are occupied by Israel. It's what the Palestinians would call Palestine. And settlers were moving into there, and the Palestinians just don't like it. You know, they feel it's their land being taken. Now, this issue erupted in a whole different manner. These are settlers who are moving in East Jerusalem into Palestinian, well, they haven't moved yet. They're trying to evict some Palestinian families and move into where they live in East Jerusalem. If your listeners haven't been to Jerusalem, it's divided into an Arab quarter, basically, and it's divided into a Jewish quarter, and then there's sort of a Christian quarter, you know, but it's Jewish and Arab. East Jerusalem is Arab. And so this became a big-time hot button where they're anticipating more people will be evicted. I did see a video of a Jewish settler who was in the east quarter, and he said, we're going to start with this neighborhood, and we're going to take all the neighborhoods till we get everybody out of here. Mm. So you've got that kind of verbiage. Then on the other end, you've got Palestinians saying you have no right to be in Jerusalem at all. So you've got this going, but the evictions and whether the court of Israel will uphold those convictions, that is what this began over and now has escalated into rockets fired and, you know, the Israelis are thinking of going into the Gaza Strip. And we sent an envoy over, but basically Netanyahu said, I am not stopping our military exercises on this issue. He's made that, I think, clear to the United States.
Wow. National correspondent Bob Ney, always great to hear your perspective on these things. Thanks so much for being with us
this morning.
All right, take care, Bob. There's something cool going on at Burlington International Airport. No, not the new flights to and from Boston, though definitely cool. No, not the Patriots planes stopping in to give the Vermont National Guard some props. Again, very cool, but not the coolest thing. The top rating belongs to what the people at Beta Technologies are working on, and it's the cover story for this week's edition of 7 Days. Here to tell us about it is 7 Days news reporter Derek Brower. Derek, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, Derek, anyone who has spotted one of the Beta's craft have been kind of stunned or taken aback. Tell people what they look like when they're out there flying around.
Yeah, you know, they're I think they're actually designed off of the Arctic tern, which is a bird known for its ability to migrate long distances. I personally think it looks a bit like the bat signal up in the sky from Batman.
It's
quite a large craft. It's one of the largest electric aircraft in development right now. And it's got these really broad 50-foot wing. A huge tail that's forked in the back, and then it's got these two cross beams that run along the fuselage, and those cross beams hold four pretty large propellers that are designed to be able to lift the aircraft straight into the air like a helicopter.
Where have they been flying, and since when?
Yeah, so if you look up in the sky most mornings in Chittenden County, you can probably see it overhead. It's been doing a lot of test flying over Essex. Earlier this week, there was they flew over Winooski and I think even Burlington. At least you could see it from Burlington. So pretty much in the Chittenden County area, you'll probably see the plane if you haven't already. You had asked how long they've been flying this
That's
for.
Right.
In the Chittenden County area, we've probably only been able to see it in the air for the last several months. They've been flying it for a few months earlier over at Plattsburgh International Airport, where they were able to do their initial flight testing. But it's really just been this year that the plane has taken off.
What exactly can these aircraft be used for?
Well, that's kind of the big question. Beta is developing a plane that they say will be able to fly up to 250 miles on a charge and carry up to six people or three pallets of cargo. So that's kind of the starting point. You look at those sort of parameters, and then you think, what would that be useful for?
Right.
Beta is a bit unusual in this field of electric aviation in that they think they are finding customers and uses for this plane and cargo. And because the plane can take off vertically like a helicopter, but it is more convenient and cheaper to operate than a helicopter, they think it will have they're finding interest, they say, in customers like UPS who will be able to station these planes at their warehouses and load them up with cargo and fly them directly to the next point along their logistics route, rather than having to truck things from a warehouse to an airport, land at another airport, and truck it back to the next warehouse. So they're hoping that those efficiencies are going to make this plane useful in the real world.
Who are the principals behind Beta Technologies?
Yeah, Beta was founded by a local entrepreneur, Vermont native, Kyle Clark. He started a couple companies in the area. First was iTherm, which is a power electronics company. He then worked at Dynapower and then started a kind of a social network for entrepreneurs called Designbook that is now VentureCo. In any case, he's an engineer from Harvard. He started the company, but what really allowed him to get off the ground with this, no pun intended, is he linked up, actually the idea to start the company came from a meeting he had with entrepreneur and CEO Martine Rothblatt. Now, she's one of the more interesting people, if you don't know who she is already. She founded Sirius Satellite Radio in the 90s and then also founded United Therapeutics, which is a biotechnology company that has a number of medicines on the market now, but has a longer range goal, quite ambitious goal of manufacturing and refurbishing human organs for transplant. And so she has been looking for a transportation solution for this organ project. This is one of the logistics of getting human organs between hospitals is one of the main barriers to being able to do more transplants. And so she's been looking for a sustainable solution on that front. And she linked up with, she met Kyle at a presentation he was giving and was struck by him. And they met for a day. And at the end of that meeting, by the next morning, they had a deal to start this company.
Very interesting. How has the company grown?
It's really quite shocking how quickly it's grown in the last year. So they've been around since 2017, but as of last summer, they had about 75 employees, and then since then, by the time my story published, it was up to over 230 employees.
Wow!
And there's no sign of so they've tripled their workforce during the pandemic, and they're continuing to grow. Kyle told me that they're expecting to hire as many as 500 people in the next year and a half as they try to get this plane certified and bring it to market. So it's really bringing an airplane to market is no small task, and it takes a lot of people to make it happen. So they are quickly becoming one of the larger companies in our region.
And Derek, with a lot of people comes a lot of money needs to go into the development of something like this. How much money have they raised, and how far are they from reaching a craft that will be viable for use by companies?
Yeah, that's a great question. This is expensive, and some analysts I've spoken to they say kind of a general rule of thumb is that they think these sorts of aircraft will take $750 million to $1 billion to get certified and bring them to market. As far as Beta has publicly disclosed, they've not raised that kind of cash. However, they are in the midst of a very substantial fundraising push. They disclosed that they raised over $140 million in new private capital in March, and they are looking to raise almost $200 million more on top of that. I asked Kyle if he has the money he needs to bring this to market, and noting that it could cost $1 billion according to some people, but he thinks he can bring this to market for less than some of the other competitors in this industry, because unlike many of the other companies developing electric aircraft, Beta is focusing on cargo transport, which they think has an easier path to market than transporting passengers in cities, which is bound to be a quite complicated and fraught endeavor. So Kyle thinks he can do it for less, and they are in the process of raising over $300 million right now to help them get there.
You mentioned competitors. Do you know where Beta is compared to the competition?
Yeah, as far as I've been able to gather consensus among people who follow this, is that Beta is among the top group of contenders. From there, it sort of varies. It's hard to rank them. There is one ranking out there that puts Beta at number two in the world for this. That's the highest I've seen. But I think it's safe to say they're certainly in the top 10 to 12. And so, you know, but it's a lot is still up in the air here. None of these companies have certified aircraft yet. The FAA has never certified an aircraft like this before. So while there are goals to get these planes flying by 2023, 2024, in Beta's case, you know, there's a lot of challenges that still need to be overcome to make that a reality.
And are they now working with the Air Force? Is that right?
Yeah, Beta is one of a couple companies that got in on the front end of a new Air Force program that more or less gives some military money to the companies that are working with them in exchange for some technical assistance from the Air Force, as well as it gives the Air Force an opportunity to sort of analyze these aircraft to see if they want to ultimately adopt them for military missions. So Beta earlier or last month got an airworthiness certificate from the Air Force, which means they can now fly test flights on the Air Force's dime, and that contract is worth up to $44 million. So it's not an insubstantial sum.
And Derek, we have a little less than a minute, but what's next now for Beta?
Yeah, so they have their prototype Aaliyah that you see flying overhead in Chittenden County, and so that's the plane they want to bring to market. They're obviously continuing to refine it. But the big steps ahead are to get the thing certified and then start producing it. Beta has not yet decided how or when they're going to start their manufacturing facility, but there are several indications, and Kyle has said that he hopes to be able to continue growing the company here. There is some land on airport property that there have been some informal negotiations, I understand, that Beta could expand on to. So I think the big thing to look out for next is to see when they decide to start their manufacturing and if they're going to do it here.
Wow. Derek Brower is a news reporter for 7 Days. You can read his story in this week's issue. You can also read it at 7daysvt.com. Thanks, Derek.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for CBS News, and then we're going to return to hear about the guy who is buying up a lot of southern Vermont. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. A local person steps forward to purchase 2 Vermont newspapers and 1 in Massachusetts and a magazine that covers the Berkshires in southern Vermont. That makes for a decent business story. But dig a little deeper and the story gets pretty darn interesting. Turns out the buyer, Pavel Paul Bellegor, has been on a serious buying spree in southern Vermont. And not a ton was known about him up until now. So 2 reporters for the Commons sat down with the new owner to learn his story. And now those 2 reporters join us. Ginny Ray, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you so much.
And Jeff Potter, welcome to you as well.
Hey, thank you so much, Rick. I'm also the editor.
Oh, okay. And the editor. Okay. Well done. Listeners, if you'd like to ask about who Paul Bellegor is or if you've had dealings with him, give us a call. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Ginny, let's start with the big media purchase. So who did the buying? What did he buy?
Jeff, you can help me out with the company name. It's not coming right
sure.
to my mind. Vermont.
Sure.
What's the name of his new company? Right.
His new company's name is Vermont News and Media LLC,
right.
And he is taking over the he's taking over three of the four newspapers that are that have been currently owned by the Newlywood Newspapers, which is a company that's whose flagship paper is the Berkshire Eagle in Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
Yeah, so it includes the Reformer and the magazine and the Brattleboro. Yep, right.
So the Bennington Banner, the Brattleboro Reformer.
Brattleboro Reformer.
And is it called Upcountry, the magazine?
Upcountry magazine.
All right. And were these publications publicly being shopped around?
Not that any of us had heard in the newsroom. It came as a complete surprise to us.
All right. And what do we know?
I believe that Paul approached the ownership.
Right. And the current ownership, Ginny, do we know how long they've owned these papers and the magazine?
They've owned them since 2016.
Okay, so yeah, 16, pretty recent. And he steps in within 5 years, not really publicly for sale, and says, "I'm going to buy them." And Jeff, am I right that the sale becomes official today?
Yes.
That's our understanding, yes.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to ask Jeff this. Why did Belagor say he was purchasing these publications?
Well, I think that it kind of falls into a continuum that was fascinating for me, because we've been kind of looking at some of his purchases of other commercial property around the area, and he kind of, when we finally got him to sit down and talk to us, he made it make a lot more sense than it looked like on the outside. What he's doing is taking properties that are in disrepair and buying them and fixing them up and trying to get them back into some sort of working order. And in his eyes, I think he sees the same thing about the daily newspapers, which have been kind of under-resourced for a number of years and are still recovering from the previous 20 years of absentee corporate ownership that literally stripped mined all of those papers into shells of their previous selves.
Jeff, do we know if he's had any previous experience in media ownership?
No, he has none, and he admits that.
And what did he pay for these papers? Do we know that? And was it a fair market value? Did he pay over what would be considered market value?
Ginny, you could back me up on this one, but I think that was undisclosed, and I don't think we've had any inkling.
That's correct.
Okay. And Ginny, in the time that New England newspapers own these publications, did they make big changes to the operation, to the content, the staff of the papers?
You know, because I am new to Vermont in a slight regard, I'm going to let Jeff take that one because I'm actually not sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that you know, and this kind of relates to what I just said about the previous ownership. When New England newspapers bought the papers in 2016, they bought a subsidiary of Digital First Media, which contained all the newspapers that were sold today and the Berkshire Eagle. They actually have done a really good job of getting of building back systems that had been outsourced to various to disparate areas of the country, and even I think at some point they were building their your local tire shop ads in India. So so all of those systems for graphic design, pagination, advertising, circulation, everything but distribution and that sort of thing, they all had been just cut.
Right.
So that's been redeveloped in Pittsfield, Massachusetts as kind of the hub. And they've invested in by the time 2016 rolled around, the Brattleboro Reformer had one solitary reporter covering an entire county. Oof. They've they've respectably hired more people into the newsroom, and that's been all of that has been good, and the paper has improved tremendously from where it was really fragile back a few years before. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, well done. And Ginny, has Belagor mm-hmm. indicated that he'd be making any changes?
He said he would essentially be a hands-off publisher. He admitted, as Jeff said, quite freely that he knew nothing about the newspaper business, but he does have technology experience. He said he would have a management team to make those choices. But he does, and also the other tangential part of the deal is that sort of a partnership with Fred Rudnick and his partners, who are frankly more interested in the Eagle because they live near the Eagle.
Mm-hmm.
And so they want to concentrate there. So housekeeping, accounting, advertising, sales will be done together for a while until the transition can be completed to having it all in-house in Brattleboro in the old Landmark building, which is now called the Innovation Box, where he's moving the offices.
All right. We're going to learn more about that coming up. But, yeah, Jeff, it's time to start to get a picture of who Pavel Paul Belagor is. I know he's from Belarus. Do we know much about his life there and what brought him to the States?
We know, and, Jenny, you back me up on this, that he came on a rowing scholarship to Northeastern University?
That's right. He majored in economics.
And, okay.
Yeah,
he never left.
And he never left.
Never went back to Belarus.
Well, not to say he didn't go back and forth. But
right,
he never
I understand.
Moved back.
Yeah.
Right. And what did he do, Ginny, as his career after college?
He worked in the financial sector. Bank of Boston, I believe, was the first one. I can't recall exactly. I don't have it in front of me. I'm sorry. I should have. But he was always there. And he said something I thought was very interesting and open. He said, I realized I couldn't program as well as the others, and so I went into sales. Mm. And he invented systems to help sell. What are they, Jeff?
International currency trading, I believe it is. And, mm-hmm. And he developed the software that took all of that marketing or that the technology that made it possible to do those transactions online.
Our
understanding, and I would frankly like to dig more into this and understand this better myself,
sure.
is that he gets a commission of sorts on,
right.
or subscription-based, it's subscription-based software, and he gets a commission on every trade that's made with this technology, like a commission or something. As you could tell, we're journalists and not
totally
remotely connected to the financial sector.
Yeah,
if we were, we wouldn't be journalists.
This is true, and you'd be buying the newspapers. Ginny, when and why did he come to Vermont?
He moved to Vermont, as far as I know, for honest. True, I think he says he fell in love with Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
He was living and it still has a presence in Bernardston, Mass. But he and his wife moved to Guilford at least 5 years ago. I spoke with one of the realtors he had met early on at that time, who said he had a large tract of land for sale that was clearly identified in Belagor's mind, in Paul's mind, that it was going to be developed, and he just couldn't handle that. He has an earnestness about open space and revitalization that came across to me as pretty real.
Mm-hmm. All right, Jeff. I'm not even sure how to start what he's purchased in Vermont because, well, it's a ton. But if you could just run through as much as you can before you run out of breath.
Okay. Just to explain to your listeners, since you're a little out of our area, we are a weekly nonprofit newsroom with a print newspaper and website in Brattleboro, Vermont, where one of these daily newspapers is headquartered. That's the Brattleboro Reformer.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been our natural focus in all of this. That is a that is a broadsheet daily. The circulation has been it's been pretty low. We've heard from various sources, but back on the rise, particularly digitally. We don't know as much about the Bennington Banner. That's a similar daily over the mountain in southwestern Vermont. A little north of that is the Manchester Journal, which is a weekly newspaper with covering that area. And the Upcountry Magazine is a glossy magazine, a real magazine.
Mm-hmm.
The owners, the New England newspapers, resurrected from a beloved publication that the Berkshire Eagle published in the 1970s, and they relaunched that with as part of their their desire to bring some of the old vibe and prestige of the Berkshire Eagle back to the news business.
Mm-hmm.
That is a free, I believe it's a free distribution magazine that they've been delivering in Berkshire County, Massachusetts, and throughout the southern Vermont, throughout the distribution area of all of the newspapers.
So, Jeff, that's the media group that he's purchased. But leading up to this, what are some of the other things that he has purchased in Vermont?
Oh. So that's a very tactful way of saying I completely misunderstood your question.
That's all right.
He's bought a lot of what I think realtors would call distressed properties. They've they range from the outlet mall just off of exit 1 on Interstate 91 that had been in disrepair for a number of years. The Landmark building, which is on the other side of town, which is that has been kind of transmogrified from a stately old mansion to a commercial building that has been vacant for, I think he said, 7 years. He bought that from the bank. He bought a long vacant commercial property, on Route 9 in West Brattleboro that had, previously been a prestigious restaurant, and most recently a mattress store, so it's got a varied and checkered past, and
quite interesting.
And so he's one of the realtors that posted on Facebook a couple of days ago made a really good point, and that if people are grousing about this guy buying these properties now, they've been on the market for years and years and years and years, mm-hmm. and nobody has. Nobody has stepped up.
Yeah. All right, Ginny, let's give Jeff a break. I want to know what the heck is Viking Village.
That is his most exciting project for him. He
yes.
really came to life when he talked about that. And that is on the 3,000 acre buys he's made in Guilford,
mm-hmm.
and he an old dairy, and he intends to create a Viking village. And why Viking? His answer was quite charming. He said they're the ones who founded this country, so why not give them credit? But he clearly has a little penchant for that sort of thing. He wants to create something of an old Sturbridge village there. With just six cabins that are rustic on the outside, but the interiors are, totally contemporary. And there'll be a large hall for dining and meetings, and the access to all the trails and the beauty of the area, the natural beauty for folks to enjoy the outdoors. I think he even called it a Disney North. So what if it becomes Disney North? Great. Jobs.
All mm-hmm. right. And he also has something called the Innovation Box. You mentioned mm-hmm. it earlier. What is the Innovation Box?
It's essentially a business incubator.
Uh-huh. All right. Great name.
Where in are located the sort of offices and presences for Vermont Beer Maker, Boston Unisoft Technologies, the Viking Farm Maple Syrup, Bellagore Properties, which is based in Dubai, a Bulgarian football team that he bought and saved when it was on the way out, mm-hmm. Vermont Vendors, which is an online marketplace for Vermont-made goods, Norm's Marina, which he also bought in Hinsdale, New Hampshire, and essentially, my sense, Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong, was that he's trying to aggregate Vermont-made products in various places to promote them and sell them.
Hmm. All
and
right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I was going to say, when I said that, his intention was because, you know, he just simply loves Vermont. He's also a smart businessman. I do believe that he has a heart for restoration, and he doesn't want to see the historic buildings all fold and go away. But he's not going to buy something at the highest ticket price either. He knows when the market is good to go into.
Yeah. Well, I'm a big soccer fan, so I did check out FC Pirin Blagoevgrad, right, which is the team he purchased. They are now sitting on top of the Bulgarian second division, and they will be promoted next year to the top division in Bulgaria. So fair play to Pavel, to Mr. Bellagore, to get them up. We're close to the end of our time together, so I do want to ask you both, because you've met him, you sat down with him. What are your impressions? I'll ask you first, Jeff, of Paul Bellagore.
Well, I think first and foremost, our job is to be objective in this sort of thing. So I don't want to be too speculative.
Sure.
My impression was he is, and this, you know, other people agree that he is a very, very charming guy. He's very hospitable. One thing that I noticed right off the bat when I met him to take a photograph, he insisted on having his photograph taken with the people who were working on renovating his outlet center.
Hmm.
He wants to be seen as somebody who is trying to be a true partner with local enterprises, and those local enterprises themselves are extremely loyal. Seem to be extremely loyal to him.
All right, and Ginny, we're almost out of time. But anything to add?
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
No, I totally agree. But as I said earlier, I found him to be earnest, and he does seem to have a vision. As well as the financial smarts. Very interesting person, and certainly personable, and actually a little bit down to earth, much more than I had expected to find him.
All right. You can read this story by Ginny and Jeff of the Commons. You can find it at commonsnews.org. Really fascinating stuff. I want to thank you both for reporting on it and sharing what you learned with us today. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's been an honor.
All right, take care. That's our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast. WDEVradio.com is where you'll find that. We've got the Governor's COVID-19 Response News Conference for, following CBS News up next. I'm Rick Singeri. I'll meet you back here on Monday.